Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another fantastic episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my two partners in crime. There's Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And there is Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
We are joined today by a very special guest to help us talk about Martin Scorsese's newest film, The Wolf of Wall Street. That is Cal Marsh, freelance film critic from all over the place, it seems. Callum, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. A few things to say at the top before we get into the podcast. My audio quality might be below my usual standards. I am in Texas currently and forgot a few key components of my podcasting setup. So I'm just using the old earbuds and built-in microphone. Hopefully that doesn't diminish your enjoyment of this podcast too much. Also, we've had some questions arising about whether or not we're going to be reviewing American Hustle. We have just decided, since I'm seeing it tonight, that we will record a mini-episode later on, either this weekend or later in the week, and that will be up. So if anyone's eager to hear about our opinions on that film, fear not, for they are coming soon. For today, however, we will be talking about The Wolf of Wall Street. As I said, we'll lead into that with our short film discussion. Today, we'll be talking about the latter-day films of Martin Scorsese, and following both of those, we will give you our picks for things coming out in the week ahead. Spoiler alert, doesn't look good. And we will also be giving you our random selection of something that we've watched on our own this week. So that's the podcast. If you have any questions, any comments, feel free to email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com or comment on this post on thefilmstage.com. And again, Merry Christmas. Give us our present. Give us a rating and a comment on iTunes. So that's that. Gentlemen, let's begin the show. Now, Martin Scorsese has a long, illustrious, and frankly overwhelming career. So we want to try to focus on only the films that he's made in the 2000s for this discussion. We can also, of course, dip into some of his latter-day work, but there's been a lot of talk about him getting up in age and a lot of words spoken about and noise made about this movie and its provocateur status even at his old age. So I wanted to talk about some of his real recent films and just see what we've thought about his later day work. So, Mr. Marsh, why don't you kick us off? What are some of your favorite Martin Scorsese movies from the past 14, 13 years? And what do you think is kind of evident in his recent production, and what does that say about him as an artist?
Okay, well, when I reviewed the film, I called it the best film he'd made since Goodfellas, which is sort of a provocative statement, I think. But it's one that I still think is true, not because the films he's made since Goodfellas are particularly bad, but because I think the one thing you can say about his later career with any certainty is that if you ask 10 critics to rank them in order of quality, you'll get 10 completely different answers. I think that's especially true of the films he's made since 2002 with Gangs of New York. And those are films that when they came out, I think garnered a lot of prestige, but over the years, people have sort of cooled on them. And I think the reputations now of films like Gangs of New York and The Aviator, it's not clear to me whether people still hold them in as much esteem. And personally, I don't particularly care for any of the films he's made in the 2000s. I think it's a bit up and down, and I'm always up and down on whether I like them. I think the last great film he made was Bringing Out the Dead in 1999, which I think is hugely underrated, rarely discussed, and is the closest thing for me to Wolf of Wall Street in 25 years.
I mean, I'll get behind you on the Bringing Out the Dead. That's a movie that doesn't get talked about nearly enough. And I was actually looking to buy that on DVD a couple of years ago, and it was almost impossible to find. At the same time, I've still universally loved pretty much everything that he's made since Bringing Out the Dead. And I remember feeling a little angry when people were talking about The Departed and saying that it was his best film since Goodfellas. Because what that really seemed to say to me primarily was, you know, Martin Scorsese, get back to the modern-ish cops and robbers type of thing. And that seemed kind of reductive of his talents. But Nick Newman, what do you think about his later day work?
I suppose, unlike our guest, I am quite fond of his 2000s work, if you want to label it that. Not only his features, but his documentaries, which I think have been terrific. I'm not sure how many of us here have seen his recent documentary work, but I love No Direction Home, Bob Dylan, and George Harrison, Living in the Material World. Those are very, very strong, very personal examinations of artists that I think there's a certain kinship he seems to have with the people he's documenting there. The same goes for A Letter to Elia, which is about Elia Kazan, and Public Speaking, about Fran Lebowitz, who actually makes an appearance in Wolf of Wall Street, funny enough, as the as the judge who gives him an angry glance at one point. So there's that, and I think that maybe in some way his documentary work defines, I think that defines 2000 Scorsese for me a bit more. But I do like his features he's made since. I mean, Gangs of New York I only saw once, something like 6 years ago, and my memory of it is slightly positive, if not enthusiastic. I think that, you know, if you had just made it about Daniel Day-Lewis, it would be one of his best films, honestly. But then there's the whole Once Upon a Time in the West angle with Leonardo DiCaprio. Not quite as interesting. The Aviator, I think, is a very handsome production and a very affecting depiction of obsessive compulsive disorder, which is something that you almost wouldn't expect from a Scorsese film in a way. And then, yeah, I mean, The Departed, if it is him kind of returning to familiar grounds, I think it's grounds that he covers as well as anybody. So fine. I'm fine with that. And then, Shutter Island and Hugo, I loved both of those films. I've seen them multiple times. I think they hold up quite well. And to me, they kind of show a master filmmaker who is, as he's getting older, he's kind of willing to flex himself a bit more, which is why maybe I can understand some criticisms toward a film like The Departed, because then you look at his two feature follow-ups and those show him really exploring new territory and getting a little wackier if need be. And then you have The Wolf of Wall Street, which, you know, you want to talk about wacky. The Wolf of Wall Street is sort of the height of that, I think. But I also do agree that a film like Bringing Out the Dead, I think, was sort of the end of a certain era for him. It is sort of like a spiritual follow-up to Taxi Driver in a lot of ways, which goes with it being set in New York, mostly at night, written by Paul Schrader. I think that a movie like that he'll probably never make again, which is too bad. But at the same time, as somebody who's appreciated what he's been doing since, if an artist wants to move on, then they should be able to move on. So,
Danny King, what about yourself?
Yeah, just to mention Bringing Out the Dead again, there's like a really nice series of interviews over at HitFix's In Contention site. The writer there, Chris Tapley, did a series of interviews with Thelma Schoonmaker. And there's one where she just sort of talks about how she and Marty are just kind of waiting for Bringing Out the Dead to like get its due, because it wasn't, I think it was just kind of like mismarketed at the time, and like people haven't quite come around to it yet, but like it's definitely seems like it's meant to happen just because of how good it is. But in terms of the 2000s work, I sort of, Gangs of New York and The Aviator, it's been the longest since I've seen those two. And I kind of agree with Callum's point where it's hard to judge if like supporters of those films are actually like fully passionate about them or just sort of appreciate them as like handsome prestige titles that maybe don't feel as personal as some of his other work. I think that the Departed might actually gain in value now after Wolf of Wall Street, just because some of that film's comedy seems connected both in the banter and just kind of like some of the improv acting that is going on in both of those films. I think there's something related. And then Shutter Island, I really hold in high regard. And I think it's interesting that a lot of people have been pointing out The Wolf of Wall Street and saying that it's like his craziest movie in a long time. Because I think that on purely formal terms, Shutter Island is like a much more exaggerated movie. I think if you compared like frame by frame Shutter Island and Wolf of Wall Street, it would be very clear to me that there's like a lot more going on formally in Shutter Island. Like I just think of that opening scene with them like on the boat and the fog, and like the score from start to finish is very, very heavy. And so I just admired that as like a kind of a very stylistic movie for him to make late in his career. And then Hugo obviously is hard not to appreciate as a standalone film, but it also helped me sort of learn about his efforts outside of making his own movies, like his preservation and stuff. And, you know, I know people might say, like, you got to separate, like, that from his own work. But for me, it's like there are a few directors who I'll, like, watch almost every interview they do just because, like, time, you know, I just don't have the time to do that. But with Scorsese, he knows so much about film. And, like, I don't think you can ignore that. Like, if I was a 12-year-old kid or something and I didn't like Hugo, it would still be like the best bad movie I'd ever seen just because of how much it taught me. And I think that you can get that from his other work too, just in terms of what influences he's drawing on. It always seems like he's sort of borrowing from the past and like reshaping it in new ways. And I think that's an important part of his value as a director.
Well, I will answer that I am a huge proponent of Gangs of New York, and I do passionately defend that movie. Too many people did so at the bar last night, actually. So, yeah, I mean...
Did you also throw knives around? Or
I did, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
I cold stabbed a guy in the back. It's Texas. You can't not stab someone in the back every now and then. So, I mean, I love Gangs of New York. I watched it a couple days ago, actually. And I like The Aviator, but I will say that that's more of just an interesting formal exercise, even in spite of the good performances and everything. It's more just a handsome production. Shutter Island, I keep forgetting that he made. And then I think that there's no other director who could have pulled off that story as well as he can, simply because of all the production and the exaggeration that he brings to it and the energy and style. So yeah, I guess this is one of my things. Like I said, when people were saying that Departed was the best film since The Goodfellas, or just Goodfellas, I keep appending definite articles onto things. What am I wrong with me? Anyway, so whenever someone says something like that, like this is a return to form, I always feel like I have to point out that the man has not stopped making excellent movies, and that there's many degrees of Martin Scorsese, and he operates in many different levels. And I think that a lot of it just comes down to what level are you looking for. And for me, I'm just looking for him to make a movie. So I'm always happy whenever one comes out.
Mm-hmm. I should clarify that when I say that the film is the best since Goodfellas, I don't mean that it's a return to form.
Okay.
Because it just happens to be the one that I like most since Goodfellas. Right. Yeah, you're right that he continues to make movies in such a way that whether or not each one is a success or failure for you, I think that it's a pleasure to have his movies arrive.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like I said with Shutter Island, like you could have gotten – it's the kind of story and the kind of pulp nonsense towards the end that it would have been very easy for a hacky director to get his hands on it, and they'd just be like, oh, it has this cool twist at the end. Let's do that. Same thing with Wolf of Wall Street. I mean, you can imagine a world in which – a comedy director like Adam McKay gets his hands on this script and, you know, makes a kind of Anchorman-esque thing about it. I mean, I was talking to people at the bar last night. It's going to be a lot of bar stories on this podcast, apparently. And they were saying how they went and saw Anchorman 2 and how it was just kind of okay and it wasn't that funny. And I told them that throughout The Wolf of Wall Street, you couldn't stop laughing. Like, it was a immensely entertaining film, 3 hours long, felt like it was an hour. And that's the kind of thing, like, you have this man who's capable of making films this good, this consistently. Anything that he touches is going to work, and that's the thing that I appreciate most about him, and especially in his latter day work, where he seems to be just really putting himself out there and seeing what he's capable of still, even at this age. And I think that is actually an excellent segue into our feature review. So ladies and gentlemen, get ready. We're about to enter the seedy world of stock trading, circa 1989 and forwards. It's The Wolf of Wall Street, directed by Martin Scorsese, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Jonah Hill. And this was written by Terrence Winter, based on the book by Jordan Belfort.
My name is Jordan Belfort. The year I turned 26, I made $49 million, which really pissed me off because it was three shy of a million a week.
We're making a name for ourselves.
Nobody knows if the stock is going to go up, down, sideways, or in circles. You know what a fugazi is?
Oh, Pugazi. It's a fake.
Hey, Fugazi, Fugazi. It's a wazi, it's a woozy, it's a fairy dust.
Was all this legal? Absolutely not. We were making more money than we knew what to do with.
The Wolf of Wall Street is the story of Jordan Belfort. It's based on a true story. He made his fortune pushing dicey stocks to people. And this is the story of his kind of rise and fall and rise and fall. It's difficult to sum up into words, but this is one of the most highly anticipated films of the year. And one that I believe already has and probably will continue to appear on a lot of end-of-year lists. So let's see what we thought about it. Let's start with the guest, Callum Marsh. What are your thoughts on Wolf of Wall Street?
It's my favorite film of the year.
All right. I was proven correct.
Yes. It's a film I almost wish I didn't like as much, only because it completely threw off my year-end list.
I had everything all set up, and now this comes in and starts wrecking shit.
Exactly. I had one film at the top of my list until literally mid-December whenever I saw it, and then suddenly I'm thrown off. But no, I thought it was great. I thought it's a film that is exceptionally vigorous and vitalic, and I know it's a point that keeps getting belabored, and you've already mentioned it, but for a filmmaker that old to have made a film like Hugo, which is, whether you like it or not, sort of a quintessential old man movie in a lot of ways. I think it was Walter Shaw or Bill Chambers who said it was that Hugo is a film that's like a jar of stale candies on your grandmother's counter. And it's just a film that seems kind of suspended in time, and it's an ode to the movies in a very wistful and I think sort of hokey way. But I won't take anyone's enjoyment of that movie as suspect. It's a very well regarded film. In any case, Wolf of Wall Street is a film that I can't believe followed that up, because it's very, very unlike everything about it. The sensibility is completely different. And I felt like I hadn't seen a film that takes a moral stance in as sophisticated a way as it does in this film. The idea of a film that, even when I saw it at a press screening sort of early enough that it was under embargo and a conversation hadn't really broken out around it, I knew leaving the theater that it was going to be a film that would be misunderstood by a lot of people. And now I don't say that in a sort of an elitist way, like I got it and I know that people wouldn't get it, but I knew it was a film whose moral stance was such that it wasn't going to be clear to people whether the film indicted or embraced the character.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of people who treat this as an aspirational film.
Yeah, and there already are. I mean, but people treat – I think – then again, these are comparisons that I'm not the first to make, and they're obvious enough, but I think they are salient. I think the film is very similar to Scarface, very similar to A Clockwork Orange, and very similar to these are not going to sound similar, but very similar to Ghost World and The Catcher in the Rye, the novel. And what those things all have in common is that people who are close to the character already going in – often have a hard time distinguishing the perspective of the author of the text and the perspective of the character who narrates them. And in all five of those cases, you have characters whose perspective is so much adopted by the text that it isn't saying, look how awful this person is, or look at this person's mistakes. And people can leave the theater or leave the book and go, I thought that character was great. And I want to act and be like that person. That's obviously not the point. But a lot of people. But the fact that people make that mistake doesn't mean that the movie is, you know, doing something wrong, I think. Does that make sense at all?
No, that absolutely makes sense. I was going to say, I showed a friend of mine the Alec Baldwin monologue from Glengarry Glen Ross. And then he was in a fraternity, and he showed it to a bunch of his friends. And he's like, this is hilarious and amazing. And all of his friends in the fraternity got the exact wrong implication from it. Whereas he and I could recognize it as being, like, a horrifying thing to tell people. All his friends thought it was great, and they basically used it and adapted it to their recruiting process for the fraternity. Those people are out there, and they will completely misread a film if it's already too close to how they are. So I'm with you 100% on that. Nick Newman, what did you think of Wolf of Wall Street?
What fraternity is giving out steak knives?
Not a good
it's
one.
It's a steak knives.
Anyway.
Second prize is steak.
So it's funny because I did love The Wolf of Wall Street, and it's an interesting thing because my reaction to it, sort of in the moment, just as it's progressing, is almost a very sort of visceral reaction. Where I mean, it is the funniest movie I saw this year, and it is immensely entertaining, probably the most entertaining movie I saw this year. But at the same time, I think that as Callum had said, what the movie is really getting at is. If not necessarily a complex thing, it is a little tricky in the sense that, I mean, there are people who will see this movie and they'll think, oh, this is encouraging the behavior because it shows it in all its debauched glory. But the key there is debauched. I've been sort of frustrated in the days since it's come out, seeing people. You know, there was this woman who wrote an awful, like, open letter to the people who made The Wolf of Wall Street and the real wolf himself, and which she said, like, oh, you know, my father was screwed over by you people and whatnot. And it's just strange to me that somebody could see this movie and think that it's promoting this sort of behavior. But then again, you know, people are dumb, so who cares? Because the movie is what it is. And I think that as an examination of greed and as an examination of sort of a certain pre-9/11 excess, I think the movie is quite spot on, and also as sort of a prescient example of what would happen to the world economy in recent years, it is quite unsettling. I think in particular the final shot of the movie really sells that. In my review of it, I actually called that the most terrifying final shot of the year. And I really do stand by that. I really do think it is a horrifying thing. And yet, sandwiched in between that is a lot of fun. You have Coke, you have sex, you have lemons. You have lemons. And not only that, but I think it's interesting how DiCaprio here is completely cut loose. It seems like something he's been embracing lately, because there's sort of this strange trilogy of rich men movies he's been making, because he had Django Unchained last year, and he had The Great Gatsby earlier this year, and now he has The Wolf of Wall Street, and all of which he feels like a completely different performer. And it's really wonderful to see that, and I think the way that Martin Scorsese encourages it in the film is exciting, particularly how he pairs it with Jonah Hill, and what they're doing is really, I mean, Jonah Hill's presence certainly does encourage this reading, but it almost does at times play like a Judd Apatow film.
Yeah,
I think. Particularly, there's a discussion of dwarves.
Oh God!
That feels taken right out of an Apatow production. and not only that, but there is the whole factor of Scorsese is this now 71-year-old man. He was 70 when this film was in production, and I mean, maybe it does affect my reading of it a little bit, because it is hard to believe he could direct something with this much energy and pull off some of the stuff he does and keep it going for 3 hours. This film is 3 hours long and it really never stops. It's a very strange thing to sit through, just because I was thinking to myself, so there has to be like a sort of a come down period. And there really kind of wasn't. It really just kept going and going and going and going. And I think that sort of that idea of maintaining this speed and maintaining this rhythm and putting yourself inside the character's headspace is exactly what the film is getting at. There's the whole matter of a Goodfellas casino comparison, which I would like to get to a little later. That might involve a few spoilers, though this is based on a true story, so I'm not sure how spoiler you could be. But nevertheless, there is the matter of that comparison, which I think is somewhat appropriate, but also implies a reading of the film that doesn't go very deep. I do think there's a film you could read deeply into. So Wolf of Wall Street is magnificent.
Okay. Danny King, what about yourself?
Yeah, I think this podcast will just be like for guys who really like The Wolf of Wall Street. so yeah, I actually I read Belfort's memoir like about a year ago, and I almost like put it down after the second page because the writing is so bad. But I kept reading it, and I'm actually glad I did, because I think like his kind of point of view while writing helped Scorsese and DiCaprio like approach this film as a comedy. Because if you read the memoir, he sort of introduces it as like a kind of confessional, like, you know, my bad, like they did some bad things, like I'm going to tell you about them. But in the actual book, he like really wants to tell us how awesome all of this stuff was. So like every time, you know, Quaalude shows up, there's like 10 exclamation points in every paragraph. And he's just like, yeah, man, the Quaaludes were so sick. Like exclamation point. Like, and I mean, that's stupid to read. Like it was a waste of time. But I think it helped like give this movie this energy. And I think the fact that it is a comedy for most of its runtime actually helps it make its thematic points like more strongly, because I think like there are certain shots in the movie that really get you to like notice the debauchery of this behavior and how like damaging it is. And the fact that everything around those shots is so funny actually makes the sort of disturbing side of the story more powerful. I think maybe the first like shot where I sort of like dropped my jaw in that way was like when this woman in the office is shaving her head for money. And yeah, there's like a period of time where like DiCaprio just says what's going to happen. We're like, oh, that's funny, someone's going to shave their head. But then like they cut to it and it's like really terrifying to watch, like this woman just humiliating herself. And so that was like a key moment. And throughout the film, there are shots like that where you're thrown out of the comedy for a minute and you're like just kind of getting punched in the stomach. And so that made for like a very well-paced experience, well-balanced film. And the other thing that surprised me, like I said, because the energy of the film is so high, but a lot of the style is very simple, at least the way I saw it. There's a lot of dialogue scenes where it's just simple shot reverse shot, and these dialogue scenes, like the best thing about them is just how long they go on for. And so I was like surprised by that a little bit, but I think it pays off. And it actually, it seemed reminiscent a little bit of The King of Comedy, in terms of its form, like just kind of this like very high key, like just simple, presentation of this, like, this kind of environment. I think like the other thing it's been compared to would be like After Hours, but I think After Hours is like a little bit more deranged formally. I think there's something about Wolf of Wall Street that's like the style is very clear in a way that kind of reveals this environment. But yeah, definitely overall, I just have to echo the praise.
Yeah, I mean, what can I say? I love this movie too. So there's not going to be a lot of a contradictory discussion. I'm going to just say ditto to everything all three of you have said. So just imagine me saying all of that in my way. If you listen to the podcast enough, I'm sure you could probably guess the way I would phrase things. I'm going to talk about some things that haven't been brought up that I really liked. In addition, you were talking, Danny, about the shot reverse shot on top of the idea of guests getting thrown out of the comedy. One of the things I love was some of the extras and the way they were directed in certain scenes. There's the first scene, and it's featured in the trailer, when Leonardo DiCaprio is talking with Matthew McConaughey's character. And there is a woman in the background who is constantly like looking at them as though she can't believe the shit that is going on at the table next to hers. And that kind of thing happens a lot, like a lot in this film. The other thing I love is the more conversational style of the voiceover work. Much like Goodfellas, a lot of the story is told via voiceover from Leonardo DiCaprio's character. It starts off with him driving a red Lamborghini, and then he like corrects the movie, and the Lamborghini becomes white. Not only that, but every once in a while he goes into like the Goodfellas style explanation of what was happening. Like, you know, when they would talk about, you know, the way they'd knock over something and how that would go. And then in this movie, he's getting into the specifics of it. And then he's like, you know what? Fuck that. Throw that out. I'll just tell you, it's illegal as fuck, but I'm making too much fucking money to care. And that was something that really sunk me into the movie just a lot. I mean, and then in that same level, the way that he'll just throw out information, there's a point where he talks about someone who killed himself, but then says, but anyway, that's not important. It's not about me and my life. And the way that the movie will cut in like a still image of the person dead in a bathtub and then throw it out just as quickly as the character forgets about it. Like, this is the kind of genius editing and writing and direction and everything that I was hoping for and expecting from this movie. And I'll say, I guess I can't say at the top because we've been talking about this for a while now. I've had a lot of movies that I've looked forward to this year. Some that have met my expectations, some that have failed my expectations. I think this is the one that most was built up in my head, and yet it was able to exceed my expectations to a degree that left me in a state of absolute shock at the end of the film. I couldn't imagine this film as awesome as it actually is. And I can't wait to see it again. It's 3 hours. I don't have that kind of time in my life, but I'm going to make it because I need to see this goddamn movie again. Mm-hmm. There's too much. There's too much to go into. Every scene is so packed with nonsense and wonder. And I'm sure I missed like half of the stuff in it because I was just buckled over laughing at some of the more absurd moments. And I, like, just anecdotally, to like, the movie theater was packed. There was a very clear distinction between the people who were willing to laugh at certain things and the people who were a little more shocked. I was saying before the podcast started that I went and saw this with my brother and a friend of his who are younger than me. They're about 19. We were laughing on the same level. All the debauchery, all the sex and drugs and violence was hilarious. Then there was my mother and father, who weren't horrified so much at the movie as they were at me and my brother and his friend laughing at everything. But end of the movie comes, and they can't wipe the smiles off their faces either. They loved it. I joked about how this was the perfect holiday film in the run-up to it. Like, it's getting released on Christmas. Get ready to, like, pile the kids in the car and go see it. It worked. It happened, mm-hmm. and it was glorious. And that's not the type of thing you can say about a film. You can't take, you know, people spanning two different generations to a lot of films and they'll get the same thing out of it. My family already has in-jokes about this film. It's a bona fide fucking classic.
In all fairness, this is exactly the kind of movie my dad would have taken me to see over Christmas break when I was a kid. So I suppose it depends on the family as well. That's a factor too. I wanted to get into something regarding, so this is what I had said before when you talked about, when I talked about how I think it differentiates itself from his 1990 mob film. I don't think that this is as good a film as Goodfellas. I mean, that's kind of a high bar to be crossing, I think. I think so. But I do think that in some sense, as a presentation of events, it is actually inherently more interesting because this is very specifically from the perspective of the main character. We're expressly seeing it through his eyes, which is what the whole Porsche scene or Ferrari, is that what he has?
I thought it was a Lamborghini.
Lamborghini? Oh, well, I don't know my luxury cars, you'll have to forgive me. That scene to me is basically what sets the film. That's sort of what calibrates the film for me, is how you have this and he's driving around and he says, no, it's this color. And then it changes mid-shot. And from that point forward, the entire movie is seen directly from his eyes. And I think that the way it's emphasized is particularly, I mean, I think it is sort of a way of Scorsese and Shoemaker, a way for them to show off a bit. The way that scenes are organized in a very unusual way, how certain moments, such as the lemon scene, as we'll refer to it, feels like it goes on for about 3 years, maybe. It feels like a very long scene, but then you have other sequences, like when he first meets Jonah Hill, which is basically cut to the bone. where you have this very strange editing pattern where he basically hands him something and then you cut to him outside in the telephone booth quitting his job. For me, it almost feels like the way – it kind of reminded me a bit of Ridley Scott's – not really. Of course not Ridley Scott. Tony Scott's Domino. Have people here seen Domino?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It reminded me of Tony Scott's Domino in the sense that it's sort of like the drug haze – it's the drug-fueled, hazy perspective of a central character that we're getting. Unlike in Goodfellas, for instance, which is almost more like an investigation or a testimonial, this to me is kind of, it's boasting. It's boasting and it's exaggerating. And I think that's why it's key that it's taking directly from Belfort's text, which I haven't read it, but I do imagine it's probably inflated a bit. Because some of the things that happen in this film, I mean, there's the yacht sequence, Scorsese uses, like in his last two movies, Scorsese is using CGI for the purposes of creating a false environment, a purposely false environment. And it feels like it's coming from, it feels like it's something conjured by someone's imagination. Or, for instance, there's also most prominent of this is probably this is, doesn't involve CGI, but as far as perspective goes, you have the whole lemon sequence where you go back and you see what actually happened, what actually happened to his Lamborghini and what actually happened on his ride home. So for me, that's why I think that it differentiates itself from the likes of Goodfellas or Casino, and I think is actually, again, I think it's more interesting as a presentation of events. So. That's something that's been on my mind since seeing the movie, and why I think comparisons are, while earned, I think it earns comparisons. I also think it diverges from them purposefully in really fascinating ways.
Yeah, absolutely. That lemon sequence, holy shit! I can't like. Here's the thing: I've had to mute my microphone during the recording of this podcast because just talking about certain things send me into fits of laughter. Just thinking about the lemon sequence is almost impossible to talk about because it turns into one of those things where I just kind of want to repeat lines of dialogue and explain it. Like, it's... The movie's good to a point of... It's almost ethereal. Like, I can't wrap my arms around it and explain it. It's just a propulsive, kinetic, insane, goddamn marvel.
One point you made, Brian, about, like, there's shots where it really quickly he'll explain like the like death of one person or the end of one person's story. I think those are also important for how they like contrast with Belfort's
own story.
Because I think one of the reasons why people might be coming out of this movie having like moral issues with it is the fact that it doesn't end with him like in prison just giving back money for the rest of his life. Like if you could have the first 2 hours of this movie could be exactly the same, but if the last shot of the movie is like him in prison, then no one, I don't think, would be complaining as much. And like that's just kind of like a really disturbing fact about the true stories. It kind of just leaves you hanging, and the movie is like made so shortly after his own life that there's just like there's nowhere to like put a definitive ending on it. And it's actually kind of similar to a recent documentary I watched called Lenny Cook, which is about like this guy who tried to make the jump from the high school to the NBA in like the early 2000s, and he wasn't drafted, and now he's like living in Brooklyn, and he's like overweight, and he doesn't have a job, and like the documentary just ends right there, and you're like, you can't end a story like that. Like, you need to tell me what's going to happen. But like the fact that it doesn't have that ending is, it's sort of implying more powerful things than just like maybe a shot of him in a prison cell would. Like, it, I mean, basically like the last shot of this movie is very meaningful. And it sort of like puts the weight on you and on the audience, and sort of makes you think about that in like interesting ways.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, we could get into spoilers, but I feel like that's pointless. Are people in agreement with me? Like, do we need a spoiler section for this?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe certain moments.
Mr. Marshall, your thoughts on spoilers?
I'm generally against the idea of spoilers being a thing, so I don't care.
He has a whole piece on it.
I mean, the thing is, the movie isn't predicated on twists. It really is like a really deranged character study that has some sharp social commentary. Nick, you talked about the last scene, or the last shot, being terrifying. But the thing about that is, that, I mean, we could say what the last shot is, and it wouldn't really affect the way that people view the rest of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. So yeah. I'm just gonna randomly say we're gonna start talking about some plot points now. If you think that's a spoiler, you know, flip to the coming attractions. But I mean, like, I agree with you. That last shot was eerie and mm-hmm. unsettling, and I was actually upset that that was the last shot from a moral standpoint. I was really hoping he'd go to jail again.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, the real Jordan Belfort is actually the guy who introduces him at the end. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I knew what he sounded like, so when his voice came on, I thought they were going to cut to like a archival video, and then it turns out no, he introduced the real guy, which is strange because I think that the movie makes him look bad, but at the same time, it is funny how the movie makes him look bad and then it gives him a cameo at the end. I almost feel like the movie's kind of rubbing it in a bit on the guy. That's the way I read it, at least. And yeah, and then the final shot, you have this crowd of people wanting to learn a get-rich-quick scheme from him. Someone on Twitter actually compared it to the, I don't know how many people here have seen A Touch of Sin, the Zhou Zhenko movie from this year, but a lot of people compared it to, well, someone compared it to the final shot of A Touch of Sin. I think that's actually pretty accurate, implying cycles, because the whole movie, I think, is sort of about kind of, you know, getting to a certain place and then being knocked down and then getting back there again. You know, you take too many drugs and then your body recovers and you go back there again. And then, you know, you crash your car, but you buy a new one. You go to jail, then you get out, and then you start over again. And the real Jordan Belfort is actually doing, from what I understand, he's doing rather well for himself right now. And that's why I think the film kind of has that's where I think the moral imperative of the movie comes from. If you could say there is a moral imperative, that makes it sound like an after-school special almost. But that's where it comes from for me, is kind of just saying, well, this is going to continue unless somebody does something about it. And that's why it's part of why I find sort of the claims that the movie is not morally rigid. That's why I find it a bit frustrating, but I suppose that's just going to happen. Maybe. I don't know. I've sort of given up in terms of cultural conversations because most of them are bad, but as this film will evidence, and as a piece by Mr. Marsh on film.com we'll discuss a bit. Certain reviews of the movie are just completely off base. But I suppose that was bound to happen. Alas.
Sadly.
Yes. What did people think of the ensemble? The ensemble performances? I thought it was quite strong. And yeah, not a surprise coming from Scorsese. Particularly, you know, it's interesting how Matthew McConaughey is positioned in this movie as kind of a guy who... He's the one who puts the wheels in motion. And I find it interesting how he doesn't appear at all later in the film. He's in it for maybe the first 25 minutes, and he has maybe 3 minutes of screen time in there. And then he's just gone. And Belfort is sort of left to his own devices. And I think it's interesting how McConaughey, yeah, he's a very kind of unique, specific actor. So he leaves a certain impression on the film, I think. The same way someone like Kyle Chandler, someone said that this is kind of like the Kyle Chandler desk job trilogy with Argo, Zero Dark Thirty, and now The Wolf of Wall Street. Kyle Chandler in this movie is basically just a face. There are so many shots of him is just a close-up of his face observing and
usually
kind of
like
grimacing.
Pinning something to a board, maybe.
Putting something on a board at a firing range at his desk on the subway. It's a close-up of his face, and you kind of see this. In that, you see a certain frustration, and you see sort of this envy of a life that that he could live easily. Because there is that scene on the boat where you see that, well, he could quit his job and within a week be working on a better shift. But I think that sort of the way that these people are coming in and out of the film, and impacting it in certain ways. And yet this does not create an inconsistency in the movie. Really speaks to the way Scorsese can play an ensemble and the way he can cast a film.
I was really impressed with Kyle Chandler's work, because it did seem at first like he was just going to be a guy sitting there. But his scene on the boat, I actually really liked the way they played that and how he kind of played up his like, oh, gee, shucks, I'm just like a poor bureaucrat. And then it actually like he turned it and became like a kind of fierce and intelligent person. Other star players whose work I loved, Rob Reiner. Jordan's father.
He probably has like the best introductory scene of like any character this year, with holy just shit, the TV and like, who the fuck is calling on a Tuesday night?
I was watching The Equalizer.
I know, right?
Yeah, I know. Everyone he missed it.
Margot Robbie as Naomi, Jordan's second wife, was good. I mean, she's fantastic in the role, but a lot of her power, you know, through the lens of the film, I guess, comes from her looks at first, and oh boy, what a knockout. Jean Dujardin.
Also a knockout.
Just hilarious. I mean,
yes.
Here's a question. This will make it easier. Was there a weak link in this movie?
I think probably DiCaprio. You just sort of, yeah.
Thank you.
Just sort of floundering.
Right. Callum Marsh, any thoughts on the ensemble? Was there anyone who you felt didn't fit in a certain way?
I had my suspicions leaving the film that Jon Favreau must have been in the film more in the 4-hour cut, because it felt very out of place, other than I suppose it maybe was a thing to cast a bunch of directors in small parts, but it seemed odd that he would walk on basically in the Iron Man 3 role and then kind of be out of the film immediately.
That's true.
Have you seen it more than once already?
I have not. No, I skipped the second press screening. I would love to, but 179 minutes is not something that I can come by very easily.
Yeah, that's unfortunately that too. I loved Joe Bernthal in this as well.
Yes.
Which is great, because I remember him from The Walking Dead and not liking him at all. So it's good to see that he's actually quite a charismatic and interesting actor.
And Shea Whigham is in it. He's like the...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, he's the boat guy. He's like, we got some chop coming up.
Oh, my God.
That's right, yeah.
Probably should listen to his advice.
I mean, someone like Jon Favreau, I imagine... I don't know, maybe like he... Maybe someone owed him a favor or something, like, because it is very strange how, he does show up and you go, oh, there he is. So there's another, I don't know if I necessarily want to say who it is, because it's a bit of a surprise, but early in the movie, another director shows up. And that's kind of a guy who appears in films every now and then. You kind of get it, because he's sort of he seems to be friends with a lot of people, and him being cast is not a huge surprise, but then someone like Jon Favreau is an odd point. I don't know. I imagine like someone, I imagine someone kind of like did him a solid or whatever. Because what else is that guy going to do with his time? Realistically.
Oh, I thought too that when DiCaprio, when he's like working at that penny stock place and he like makes his first big sale and everyone's listening to him, it sounded like Scorsese on the other end of the line.
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah, okay. Just check in on that.
Yeah, very, very distinct voice. So.
Yeah, it was like, because he bought the stock and then Leo like got money, so that was good for his character.
Right. The first person who swindles is the person who makes a movie about him, which is kind of like, but
some good meta commentary.
Yes.
Any final thoughts to throw out before we move on from our emphatic love fest?
Just to mention one more piece I really liked, Bill Ghiabiri on his blog, he sort of like compared it to Scorsese's concert films, kind of on the basis of like these office sequences where DiCaprio gives these really long, monologues, and it's just kind of like him performing. And I'm actually not familiar with those concert films that Scorsese's made, but I actually really like the comparison, because it does feel like in those moments that the movie is kind of like standing still and it's just like DiCaprio basically running the show for like really long stretches of time. And each speech kind of has a different rhythm than the one before. And I think that those function really well within the film.
All right. Actually, I'll throw out one more thing. I think Leonardo DiCaprio does some of his best nonverbal acting ever in this film. There are just reaction shots that he has that are just like stop the movie cold with laughter.
Mm-hmm. When he's jumping around in frustration when his wife accuses him of cheating. Yeah.
He keeps throwing the water on him. Oh my God.
Right. I will say that, yeah, I mean, in thinking back, when I saw this film, I went back to my dorm room that night, and I lied down in bed, and I was trying to go to bed, but I couldn't fall asleep because I just kept laughing out loud thinking about moments from this movie. One use of Hip Hop Hooray, for instance, set on a boat, which, you know, I mean, the thing is that the movie has kind of stuck with me in that way. Just sort of these moments that you completely, that sort of get lodged in the back of your mind because there's so much going on here and there's so many ostensibly bigger moments. You know, that to me is kind of, that's sort of my main, just in a visceral level, that's my main takeaway from the film. And I wonder how they're going to do a TV edit of this movie.
They will never because, be able to.
You talk about, you know, there was when Scarface, the De Palma version premiered on TV, people, I think it was like Martin Bregman who said, you know, I got the call and they said, you're crazy, that'll never work. And it really kind of doesn't work. But you can, you know, you can work through curse words. This, I really don't know how you're going to do.
It'll be a television an version. Hour and a half
I'd be curious to see
commercials.
It. Yeah. Yes. I imagine it'll be an abomination.
Any final thoughts before we move on?
No, I think so. I think that's fine.
All right. Excellent. All right, now that we've given all the love we have to Wolf of Wall Street, let's talk about the stuff that's coming out next week. Oh boy. Coming to Blu-ray and DVD, we have Don John, the directorial debut of Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Anyone see that?
No.
No. What'd you think?
It was fine. You know.
All right.
It was all right. I'd Redbox it. I'll give that a Redbox recommendation. Callum, did you see Don John?
I did not.
Okay. What about CBGB?
Oh God. Oh wow.
I did not see this. I've heard nothing.
I've heard that's like one of the worst films ever made. So no, I've heard it's a complete like desecration of that institution and everyone who contributed to it. I'll never see that.
It's a weird hypothetical from Nick Newman. Then we have Hell Baby, which I heard was funny,
you know, I think it was written by Ken Marino, I believe.
Yeah.
It was written by sort of that crowd. I generally find their stuff funny, so that's, you know. Anyway, there's a movie called Ninja 2, which I've heard some things about. Has anybody heard about this film?
Sequel to Ninja?
I suppose it stars Scott Adkins, who's kind of the direct-to-video sort of a direct-to-video figurehead. Okay. It's supposed to be. From what I understand, it's quite entertaining.
Yeah, it's
Scott Adkins, Universal Soldier, Day of Reckoning. You've seen it?
I have not seen it, but I've heard from the sort of vulgar auteurist crowd that it's supposed to be good in the same way that a lot of those films are.
Okay.
I understand that it's sort of this year's, Universal Soldier or whatever. The Undisputed films are more like, so is, what is the other film that he directed that's, so something else that he directed that's direct to video that people quite like, or direct to VOD, I guess is the term now, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard really good things about all those. I haven't made the time to watch them, but I guess, yeah, that's at least the most interesting choice coming out.
What about Last Love?
I've never even heard of that film.
Just looks like really sincere.
I mean, it's got that kind of like Instagram sepia tone, two people on either half of the box art looking in different directions.
Yeah, like I would be stunned if that's not a like really sincere film.
The director of Ninja 2 was Isaac Florentine.
Yes.
He's made Undisputed 3.
Which is supposed to be quite good as well.
All right, yeah. He has definitely has a wheelhouse there.
All
right. Disputed 2 as well. So,
all right, so Ninja 2.
I do love the directed video. That might be the best release.
I think that it could be. At least on an interesting, like, strange level, yes, I believe it could be. So let's talk about what's coming out to theaters next week. Sorry. Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones, The Best Offer, Beyond Outrage, Interior Leather Bar.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interior Leather Bar, that's a James Franco film.
Yes, it is.
Which is sort of taken from, sort of inspired by Cruising, the William Friedkin movie. So I'll probably never see that. For
So this
I would recommend avoiding that.
You seen it?
I have reviewed that film on 3 separate occasions now. You can believe that. I reviewed that film when it played at Hot Docs in Toronto last year. I reviewed the film when it played at the Outfest, the Queer Film Festival in New York, in August. And I reviewed the film for the next issue of The Village Voice as it's open in New York. And each time I have gotten increasingly angry with the fact that it is an extraordinarily bad film.
All right. You're the Van Helsing of reviewing Interior Leather Bar.
Indeed. James Franco continues to pay my bills by giving me occasion to write about his film. But...
All right. So, like I said, we'll be doing a mini review of American Hustle, depending upon when we all see it, and that'll come out. I think next week, since it'll be the first weekend in January, we will actually be giving you our top 10 selections for the year. Did everybody have their top 10 list ready?
Yeah, I do.
It's getting there.
Yeah. Last year, I had an incredibly hard time making a top 10 list because I didn't like 10 movies that much. And this year, I've got like 30 that I have to choose from. So, way to go, movie release schedules.
I also have to see Saving Mr. Banks before we
record
that episode.
Absolutely. Yeah. I actually do have some I'm still trying to see. I want to see Mud. I want to see Dallas Buyers Club. Apparently, I just need to catch up on all my McConaughey. But
you should catch up on some good movies too.
Whoa! Shots fired! Shots fired! No, I mean, I feel like I've seen pretty much all the ones that have been getting the most universal love. But I don't know. You know,
seen The Croods?
The Croods. I did see The Croods actually.
Oh, that's right. You did see The Croods. Yeah, with your.
That was a cute
with your
movie.
Nephew or something?
No, I saw that alone. It was for the TV show I do. The Croods wasn't
terrible. Oh, wow.
I'm sure that in the world of animated films that came out, The Croods was 10 times better than Airplanes.
So I
think I liked Turbo more than I liked The Croods, though.
I mean, you're sort of really kind of painting yourself into a corner here.
Well, I mean, we're talking about kids' films. What can I say? Anyway, let's get me out of this death trap of a conversation. Let's each say a film that we watched on our own throughout the week that we feel like the people at home should check out, and then we can get on our way. So, Nick Newman, what's a film that you saw this week? And I'm just going to start that whole sentence over. Nick Newman, why don't you start us off? What's a film that you saw this week you think people should check out?
Sure. Actually, probably the best movie I saw in the past week that isn't a 2013 catch-up would be Our No Displeasure's A Christmas Tale from 2008, but it's past Christmas, so who cares? instead, I'll go with a movie that you can actually see right away, which is Targets, a 1968 film that marked the editorial debut of Peter Bogdanovich. It stars Boris Karloff and is sort of this diptych tale of on one side, you have this aging horror film icon played by Boris Karloff, very much based off of him. In fact, there's even a sequence where they play footage from a Howard Hawks movie that Karloff had starred in, but it's as the character that he's playing. That's supposed to be the actor who's in the film. It's kind of a strange thing. And then on the other side, you have this young man who has these murderous impulses who finally begins to carry them out because his family, the family he comes from, is kind of a gun-loving household. And it's something that you would not necessarily think of as a natural pairing, but the movie, the movie talks about this relationship between screen violence and real violence and the way that films have changed and how the real world horror is so much worse than horror that used to be put on the screen. The film, I think, is didactic as all hell, but in being didactic, I think it really reveals some kind of terrifying truths about about the way that films can influence people, and also the way that, to that end, there is an unpredictability that comes with violence. It's an immensely entertaining movie, but it's also something that really kind of disturbed me in a very profound way. This is actually a movie that compelled Peter Bogdanovich to write an article for the Hollywood Reporter after the Aurora shootings last year, because the climactic scene takes place at a drive-in theater, and it's really quite horrifying. But the film itself is rather good. It's hard to believe that was Bogdanovich's first feature, because it's rather elegantly crafted. And Boris Karloff is excellent. And there's also an early cameo from Jack Nicholson, back when I don't think that would have even counted as a cameo because nobody really knew who he was. But one of his first acting roles is Jack Nicholson in the film within the film. So that's amusing as well. So Targets by Bogdanovich, it's very, very good. And it's on Netflix. So all right. Off with that.
Cal Marsh, what about yourself?
Well, it's a tough act to follow. I didn't see anything this week as good as Targets, but I did see a film last night that I quite liked. A film from this year, actually, called Plus One, which is a science fiction dramatic comedy, I suppose you could say, by Denis Iliadis, who directed the remake of The Last House on the Left. It's a film in a genre I find myself increasingly drawn to. This year has a couple big examples, the two best being Her and The World's End. Films which have sort of high concept science fiction premise, which is in fact a sustained metaphor for some other idea. In Her, it's a sort of about a relationship, has a digital relationship as a stand-in for a real one. In The World's End, it's sort of an alien invasion as a stand-in for coming-of-age story or a movie about turning your back on the past. And in this case, it's about a high school, last party of the year blowout celebration as a stand-in for having to sort of reinvent yourself for college. It's about – has anyone seen it, Plus One?
No, I haven't.
It sort of came and went earlier this year. IFC Midnight put it out. The film critic Miriam Bale had recommended it to me, but as it's IFC, anyone has ever tried to watch a film from IFC's online proprietary screener service, it's basically impossible.
Yeah.
So I finally now caught up with it. It's about a science fiction phenomenon is not really explained that causes a party full of people to basically double. So everyone at the party has an exact replica, and the replicas are basically 10 minutes behind everybody else. So everything at the party is happening twice. And the movie sort of plays out like Nacho Vigalondo's Time Crimes, if anyone's seen that.
Yeah.
Because of the time delay, everything's sort of repeating itself. And the slight changes that are introduced in each timeline start affecting the things that are happening 10 minutes earlier. And I really liked it a lot. I wasn't expecting much from it, but it's kind of a sleeper hit this year, I think.
Huh.
It's available on VOD.
That sounds
fascinating.
It's very good. David Ehrlich kind of said in a dismissive way that it's a Shane Carruth movie without Shane Carruth. But I think Shane Carruth movie without Shane Carruth, one of the plus sides is that it becomes a little more fun and sexy rather than rigorous and mathematical. So take that as you will.
Yeah.
All right. Fantastic. Danny King, what about yourself?
Yeah, I watched a lot of good things this week. one a couple days ago. It was called Jericho, from 2008, directed by Christian Petzold. And I think Nick, one episode mentioned Petzold's Barbara, which is his most recent film. Jericho is the feature he made before that one. And I think I might have liked it even more than Barbara. Not that I could really say anything bad about Barbara, which is a very good film. But Jericho is a kind of a reworking of A Postman Always Rings Twice. And it's very elegant directorially, but one of the things that surprised me most about it is the way that Petzold like dishes out this narrative information in ways that are both kind of deceiving and surprising, just sort of withholding information and then presenting it at turning points. And so he creates this weird rhythm where like he'll tell you something and when you learn it you think you're ahead of the characters, but then he'll like throw in another piece of information and then you're just like, okay, now I have no idea like who's on whose side and who's in what like position. And so it's very kind of a jarring experience narratively, but also like really surprising and thrilling. And so I would definitely recommend that one. I'm curious to see Petzold's earlier work now.
All right. I watched a lot of Christmas movies.
Were any of them good?
Yeah. There's the Alistair Sim, A Christmas Carol adaptation called Scrooge. I think that's universally recognized as one of the better ones. It's very, very good. Very good. I also watched It's a Wonderful Life.
Sure.
Is anyone going to be like the one guy who wants to pretend that he doesn't like that movie?
You know, I've actually never seen that film.
What the fuck, Nick? Come on.
The thing about that movie is that once it's past Christmas, like, why am I going to watch that movie? Realistically. I'll watch, you know, every Christmas, usually the period between like December 20th and December 24th, I try to find a spot to watch it and then I kind of don't. And this was just such another year. I actually thought to myself, okay, this will be the year I'll finally sit down and I'll watch it. And then I didn't. So I never seen that. Anyway.
That's just weird. Watch? I mean, okay, so that's like saying that you won't watch Die Hard when it's not Christmas. Because honestly, Christmas doesn't play into it that much.
I mean, well, I wouldn't know because I've never seen It's a Wonderful Life. So. Right.
Well, you maniac. Anyway, so It's a Wonderful Life is amazing. And then Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, another Frank Capra film starring Jimmy Stewart. Also fantastic. Have you seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Nick?
No, I haven't.
God damn it, man. Wow. Has everyone else seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington?
I've seen It's a Wonderful Life, but not Washington.
Sorry,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I watched like 10 2013 films in the span of a week to catch up on my top 10. I would not recommend doing that. Don't do that. So Mr. Smith Goes to Washington could not be fit in. Anyway.
Okay, anyway. Callum, have you seen these films?
You know, I'm ashamed to admit that I've never seen It's a Wonderful Life.
Holy.
So, Nick, don't feel so bad.
All right. Yeah,
I mean, these as universal things. Thinking,
yeah, sure.
I think it's partly because I never grew up on it. I was never shown it as a child, and I think it must be something inherited for a lot of people as a sort of family film, but I've never sought it out on my own in the same way that a lot of films whose status is so universal. So there's something that causes me almost impulsively to not want to finally see it. I don't know it's sort of a perverse rejection of the canon in a way. That's if I've gone this long without seeing it, it's almost like I have a harder time catching up with it.
It becomes like a shame thing.
It's weird.
Thing.
It is. I think partly shame keeps it out of my mind. I don't know.
It's like when you haven't gone to the dentist for a while. And you're like,
yes, you don't want to go.
You know you should. You're like having nightmares about your teeth falling out, but like you're so concerned about what's going to happen when you finally do go that you just stop thinking about it.
That's right. I think Nick and I should both watch It's a Wonderful Life and then live tweet it for the first time. Our impressions as we go along. and when we should write about if we don't like it, we should write a piece about how everyone is wrong and it's actually a terrible film.
Here's the thing. It's like these are two films
published on film.com.
Yes.
They're both great films, like legitimately like well-made film. I mean, it's fucking Frank Capra. Like I don't know. They're the type of film that could like never really get made today because it would be so maudlin. Like the DVD cover would be exactly like the cover of that Love movie that I can't even remember.
Last Love.
Last Love.
Yeah, that could be a really good film.
Yeah, but they're just such like a, and they get bleak, man. They get fucking dark, but like they have such a hopeful view of humanity. It's really refreshing to sit down and watch both of those films. So, because apparently people like Nick and Callum exist, I'm just gonna say Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and It's a Wonderful Life.
I have seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington,
but Nick hasn't. So
yes.
So you liked Mr. Smith Goes to Washington though.
Yeah, and I also love Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. I love Capra generally. I just have never seen
It's a Wonderful Life.
His most famous film and perhaps the most famous film ever made.
Good Lord. Okay, well, that's an interesting and depressing way to end the podcast. I hope everyone has had fun at home. Thank you for joining us. But we probably won't talk to you before then, so Happy New Year to everyone out there. Hopefully you're spending time with family and friends. If not, you know, that sucks. You should try to be more outgoing. So, gentlemen, let's tell the people where you can be found online. In the meantime, Nick Newman.
You can find me the filmstage.com, tour.com/TexasForNewman, and trying to make that 1 mile home from the country club.
God. Danny King.
Filmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
Callum Marsh.
Twitter.com/CallumMarsh and basically wherever I can find work.
All right. And you can find me at my personal site, dearfilm.net. Again, we're still publishing all of our end of the year best of lists over at the film stage, so check those out. You can also find me at twitter.com/BrianJRowan and sitting around waiting for these goddamn lemons to kick in. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Stop by next week when we'll be giving you our top 10 of the year. Now you got to do the scream.
Ah! There.